Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The heat wave continues to intensify despite some showers and thunderstorms. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. And just the latest news, Governor Martin O'Malley is asking federal officials for drought relief for 13 counties, including much of the Eastern Shore. A drought warning has been issued for the Eastern Shore by the Maryland Department of the Environment. Meanwhile, there have been 38 heat-related deaths in Maryland, surpassing last year, and energy companies are urging customers to conserve power. Take a look at the impact of the heat wave and what is being done about it. On the phone with us is Jay Apperson. He's with the Maryland Department of the Environment. Also, our in-studio guest, Matt Lukovich. He's with the Delmarva Power, as well as Jennifer Johnson, who is with Wicomico County Health Department. Welcome to the show. Jay, I want to turn to you first of all and give us the latest here, because I understand that we have this warning that's in effect. And there's also an effort to get some kind of relief for the Eastern Shore as well. What's been going on there at the state level?
Well, at the Maryland Department of the Environment, we monitor the water conditions for water supply usages. Right now, in April, we put the eastern region of Maryland, which is the Eastern Shore up as far north as Kent County, in a watch status. And last week, as we continued to monitor the conditions, we moved it into a warning status. And that means a couple things. It means that we'll be increasing our frequency of monitoring even more. We want to spread the word that people should take a good look at their water use and conserve water when possible. Businesses, governments, individuals, everybody, so that we can conserve the water supply and not sort of draw from the bank any more than necessary.
Now, I understand that we've been asked to cut back. Is it 15% water usage? What's the directive there for folks?
Well, there are recommendations for actions to be taken that were put into place after the 1999 drought, and we follow that. And under the stage three, the warning, the reduction goal was 10% to 15%.
And as I understand it, this is really sort of one level below emergency. If we moved into that category, what would we be looking at?
Well, under an emergency, the governor would declare a drought emergency, and at that point, that's when you start to see mandatory restrictions on non-essential water use.
Mm-hmm. And what is it, there are a lot of farmers out there who are utilizing, for instance, the sprinkling systems, the irrigation systems, trying to keep ahead of it, even though, as I understand it, even at that, with the high price of water and so on, it's very expensive. Would they also be curtailed at this point? What's the situation with the farmers out there?
Well, again, not aware of any mandatory water use restrictions. Local water systems can on their own, by assessing conditions, they can impose restrictions, on their own, aside from what the state would be doing. But we understand that farmers need water to do their business. So that being the case, though, everybody should be looking to cut back on the water use wherever they can, especially for non-essential uses.
Now, I understand that there is rainfall, I guess, in our forecast, and we've been seeing some sporadic rainfall over the past few weeks, even despite the fact that we've had this drought. Does that help at all? Does that mean anything? What do the wells look like? I know you have some monitoring wells that you have. I think they're 10 in Wicomico County. What's that situation look like?
Well, obviously any rain helps. That's obvious, but the way we assess the conditions are, we look at what we call the four indicators, and actually there are three that apply in the eastern region, because the fourth is reservoirs. They're in the Baltimore area, and they're actually basically full. But the three other than that are groundwater, stream flow, and precipitation. So we look at all these indicators to get a good idea of what those conditions are. And the other thing that I need to note is that our definitions and what we're as we define drought and what we're looking at here are for water supply purposes, and that's a little bit different. You'll see different descriptions of the conditions depending on who's giving them. And for example, agriculture, they're going to look at it a little bit differently. They're going to look at things like soil moisture levels in the soil, for example. But we're looking at overall sort of the overall water supply, and is it going to be able to meet the needs for all of society's uses? So that's why we look at these indicators. Right now, the stream flow is actually in emergency status for the eastern region. And we look at that because there are uses for stream flow. It could be used for irrigation, in some cases for drinking water, probably more irrigation on the eastern shore. And it's also, that level was a function of rainfall and a function of groundwater levels as well. So the groundwater levels are not in emergency status, but when you add it all up, that's where you get to where we moved from watch to warning for the eastern shore.
This is slightly outside of your bailiwick, but what does all of this mean in terms of the Chesapeake Bay? Because at this point, I assume that the water levels are dropping, and what does it all mean in terms of the bay and that we live with so often, so close to?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into the health of the Chesapeake Bay, and probably the biggest issue, and it's the one that we take the lead on at the Maryland Department of the Environment, is what we have what's called the Watershed Implementation Plan. That's to meet the Chesapeake Bay pollution diet, and what pollutants we're talking about there, we're talking about nutrients, and when you have they can be, and we're working to reduce those nutrients. So that's what causes the so-called dead zones, because what happens is nutrients cause algae to grow and bloom. The algae dies off. The algae in that process consumes dissolved oxygen out of the water, and that's the oxygen that the aquatic life needs to live. So we're working to reduce the amount of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, from the waterways. And I can only tie that into the situation here where if you have a lot of runoff, that's one source. There are various sources. It's wastewater treatment plants, stormwater runoff, septic systems. All these are sources of nutrients, agriculture as well. But when you have a lot of rain and a lot of runoff, then you have higher nutrient levels. So it can kind of go different ways depending on the weather conditions. Sometimes it helps and sometimes it hurts.
I was going to say, with the current drought and a fairly low level in terms of rainfall, I think we're like 70%, of normal. It would seem as if, ironically, that we might be winding up actually producing less nutrients running into the bay, and i.e. less dead zones. I mean, I might actually ironically have some positive impact on the bay.
It could in that regard. And conversely, with the tropical storm, the hurricane last fall, that washed a lot of that was a lot of rain. Obviously, that washed a lot of nutrients into the waterways, and that's why we ended up with an algae bloom in the Baltimore area in around Memorial Day that killed over 100,000 fish. And really, that was what had happened there. All the nutrients that were washed in the fall, when there was a lot of rain, that led to a massive algae bloom, and then when it began to die off, fish began to die off. So, when we talked about that, we just really emphasized that was really underscored the need to reduce nutrient pollution in the local waterways in the bay.
Why don't I turn to the impact in terms of people trying to deal with this? As I mentioned, I think, earlier, there's about 38 deaths in Maryland in 2012. That's up from 34 total in Maryland last year. And apparently the last four actually occurred earlier this summer and was connected with the idea that there wasn't any air conditioning after the derecho storm. And, Jennifer, this has, I guess, been the hottest it was certainly the hottest July that we've ever had, certainly for Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and New York. It's been tough. For instance, in Newcastle County, we saw the temperatures up to here around above the 90s, 17 days, I guess, with, 2 days, July 7th and 18th, actually, over 100 days. How's that impacted people in terms of how they're dealing with it? And have we seen more people come in, say, for instance, who had health problems that have been impacted by this? What's the situation there?
Well, I think that one of the issues with this year is, like you said, they were consecutive days, where last year it might have been a high heat day one day, but it wasn't continual days. So, and I think, you know, a lot of people are trying to conserve energy and, you know, maybe not using their air conditioning, or some may not have air conditioning. So, you know, we implemented two cooling centers, or two different times a cooling center this year, in hopes that people would come out and utilize the air conditioning, you know, at the Wicomico Civic Center.
I was going to say, now there seems to be a number of cooling stations, I guess, up and down the peninsula, particularly at the libraries. But as I understand it, are these open, like, just generally speaking, as cooling stations, or do you open them particularly for particular days? I mean, what's the criteria here? Because I can imagine, particularly as I was watching and trying to sort of report on which libraries were open and not open, and when they were going to be open and not open, you couldn't really tell, because the weekend came, okay, they were open during the weekend, but then the rest of the week, the following week, it was really hot. I mean, what should somebody expect here?
Well, like I said, when there's consecutive days of high heat, that's when a cooling station would be opened. Now, on any other given day, you know, we do recommend to go to the mall or to the library if it's you know, if it's pretty hot. But we look at consecutive days of heat in order to open the cooling station. So other than that, people could go to a day center or, you know, the mall or the library where there is already air conditioning.
So what kind of things, then, do you have the cooling center to help them out?
Water is supplied. We also, of course, they have air conditioning, but we do recommend that they bring their own medication, you know, and different stuff like that. So it's important, like I said, for them to be in a place where there is air conditioning. I think sometimes people feel, if I just have a fan on, you know, that that's cool enough. The other important thing is, when we say you need to check up on the elderly, sometimes we really need to go to their house and check on them. Sometimes we might think it's okay to just give them a call, but you really need to go and kind of assess how hot is it in their house, you know, because sometimes the elder, you know, older people don't want to bother somebody, and to them it may not feel too hot. The other thing, too, is if they're having heat exhaustion, you know, they might be a little out of it. You know, they might not be able to think straight. So them saying, "I'm fine," over the phone, you really need to go to their house, check out how hot is it in there, you know, and remove them, take them to your house or to a cooling center. You know, there was free transportation for the cooling center through Shore Transit. So, you know, we were hoping that people would really take advantage of it.
Now, by the way, in terms of the cooling centers, is there any medical help that comes by? I know some of the libraries, I know, certainly in Delaware, you would have people who would come by and check things out. What's the situation here?
Absolutely. We, at the health department, the nurses are basically on standby in case anybody is in need of medical attention. There are other people there manning the cooling centers. So at any time, somebody could absolutely get help if needed, if, you know. And the other part is, a lot of times these people have other conditions that the heat just aggravates these chronic conditions. So, you know, that's, again, sometimes, you know, they think that they're okay, but it's important to really monitor that, drinking water. And the other part, too, is to be prepared. You know, when you know that bad weather is coming, then be prepared to say, okay, where am I going to go if I do not have air conditioning? Or, you know, am I going to call a relative to make sure that I can go to their house? You know, those are the important things, too, to kind of be prepared ahead of time.
So if particularly if I go to someone who is elderly, or even if I'm trying to assess my own situation, what signs should we be looking for in terms of whether or not we perhaps may be in over our head, that we're probably maybe being affected by the heat detrimentally, even perhaps at the point of heat exhaustion? I mean, how do you gauge, how do you know that?
Well, I mean, if they seem kind of a little out of it, you know, like they're not thinking straight, then a lot of times that has to do with, you know, their body temperature is rising. You know, that's the problem, is maybe they're not sweating, or, you know, that their temperature of their body is rising. So it's causing a little bit of, you know, they could go into dehydration. So it's important to make sure that they're drinking water. Their face could be flushed. You know, that's the other thing, too, with young people, they go outside and they think they're fine, they're running around, but it's important for the parents to make sure that they come in and get cooled off, make sure they're drinking water. Try maybe not to go out in the heat of the day, in the middle of the day. Maybe go out in the morning or later, you know, in the afternoon sometime.
So, and if I'm sort of looking at me, or if an individual is looking at themselves, what should they be looking for in terms of their own personal? I mean, is one thing to be able to see somebody and say,
right.
I see these things, but we tend to discount, as you say, some of these things. We say, I can do this. How cautious should we be?
Well, you know, be aware of how you're feeling. You know, if you're feeling really groggy, you know, the heat certainly can play a big impact on that. If you know you haven't been drinking water, and water is important because sometimes if we might drink juice or something with a lot of sugar or alcoholic beverages, which dehydrate us, you know, it's important to remember that the water is what's going to help to hydrate you and not wait till you're thirsty. I think sometimes people just wait until they're thirsty to drink, but if you're constantly drinking the water and you don't get to the thirsty point, then that's better for you also.
Now, have we, I don't know if they've been monitored this, but have we seen more people now going to the, showing up in the, say, emergency rooms or hospitals or whatever, or even clinics, suffering from the effects of the heat? What's the situation with that?
Yes, there has been an increase, and like I said, I think it really has to do with the consecutive days of the high heat and the humidity, you know, and that's why we need to really make sure that people are watching when they know the high heat is coming, to prepare themselves ahead of time, like I said, to know that they can go somewhere where there is air conditioning. And, you know, don't use the oven because it heats the house. You know, different things like that. You know, it's important to, like I said, be prepared for those situations.
Yeah, so if I have somewhere, or I find somebody who I think may be suffering from heat exhaustion, that looks serious. Maybe they, whether it's their mental state, or perhaps they've even, I can't wake them up, as it were, or they're slight, you know, in a sort of twilight. What kind of response then should they expect then, say, if I take them to the emergency room? Because everybody has talked about emergency rooms, and a lot of times you'll have lots of waits and so on. How is a hospital, how are the facilities, you know, dealing with that in terms of the response?
When they get to the hospital, I'm sure they would monitor and look to see how severe it is. I mean, if they're not conscious, I'm sure they would take them right back. I mean, and call 911, go by ambulance, you know, and you'll get in there very quickly, because if somebody's not responding, that's very serious.
And by the way, the things that we should have at home, what kinds of things should we have at home to beat the heat, as it were, aside from obviously making sure that there's air conditioning?
The water, you know, don't wait till you're thirsty. Like I said, drink the water. The other thing is to be prepared when we have quite a few consecutive days of high heat, there could be a chance that we lose electric. So, you know, that in the back of your mind, you need to be aware of that, too. And what can you do? Making sure you have batteries so that you have radios so that you can hear what's going on, you know. And, you know, like I said, being prepared is the biggest thing. The water and, you know, watching the news when you know it's going to be consecutive days, you know, lowering your air to a – or putting the air up, you know, maybe while you're not there. The other hard thing, I think, is with the economy the way it is, maybe there's people that have air conditioning, but they're not using it. So, you know, it's important to know that, you know, you need it. You know, it doesn't have to be at 60, but you do need it when these levels of high heat come, you know, that you definitely need to use it. And the other thing, too, is be prepared before you start using your air conditioning to make sure that it's in good condition before the summer hits, too. That would be a hard thing, that here's summer and I go to turn it on and it's not working, right? So
I actually had that happen once a long time ago. Well, speaking of power, Matt Lukovich, he's with Delmarva Power. First of all, what has been the situation? How have you been hit? I haven't seen any, like, major blackouts. I know we had some storms that came that obviously produced their own particular problems. But what's the situation with the electrical power at this point?
Well, interestingly enough, as you mentioned, it's been probably one of the hottest summers we've had in quite some time. In fact, my 20-plus years with the utility company, this might be the hottest summer I've experienced in all the years I've been there. We have seen a little bit of an increase in energy usage compared to last summer. But interestingly enough, we have not come anywhere near setting a record on any given day for peak energy usage. So I think that's a combination of the fact that of our energy conservation programs that are in place that we offer to our customers in Maryland, And also the fact that people are just a little more energy conscious, trying, because of the economy, you know, trying to make ends meet, looking for ways to save. So I think it's a that's one of the key factors is the conservation. Secondly, over the last couple of years, we've made significant improvements in our infrastructure, increasing the voltage in some of our transmission lines to accommodate increased load. So I think that, coupled with some conservation, has allowed us to get through the summer in good shape in terms of reliability. As you said, storms do come, and they have their own set of issues as far as, you know, when power goes out. But as far as reliability on any given hot summer day, we've been in pretty good shape, even though there's been an increase in energy usage. We haven't set a record on any given day.
So it's so if I'm like out there and I want to certainly stay cool. On the other hand, I want to make sure that, you know, if the cooler it is, the more expensive it's going to be, and especially for people in this hard economic times. What should they be doing? What should they be thinking about in terms of keeping that the house cool?
Well, like Jen said, the first thing, if you haven't done so this year, is get your cooling system checked by a professional. Make sure it's tuned up properly. A central air conditioner accounts for about 30% of your energy bill. And if you don't have it in proper working order, the usage, the energy usage will increase because it's working harder to keep you cool. We recommend that customers set the thermostat level in the summertime at 78 degrees. And we always say that for every degree you can raise the thermostat in the summertime, you save about 3% on your energy bill. I've had people say to me, well, 78 is very uncomfortable. It just doesn't feel cool. I suggest then consider getting ceiling fans installed if you haven't done so. Put the ceiling fans on low. It circulates air through the room, gives more of a sense of comfort. I say if you're not comfortable with the 78 and you have to have it lower, you have to find your comfort level. The only thing is, the lower you put that thermostat, be prepared to pay a little bit more because you're going to be using more energy. But when it comes to that, set the thermostat at the proper level, maintain the system with a professional checking it at this time of the year. The other thing, a simple thing to do, is change the filter every month. A lot of people let the filters stay in there for several months. A dirty filter makes the unit run harder, which means it's going to increase your energy bill.
So, in terms of the impact, you seem to be indicating that despite the heat, we're looking at fairly decent situation with the power, with the maybe the exception of storms. How have the storms complicated this? Because I guess we're supposed to have another one at least coming down the road. Who knows what that'll produce? And particularly these are thunderstorms, which are particularly a problem. What's your response like? Because I know some of the utilities, for instance, up near Baltimore, have been sharply criticized for their response times. What are you guys doing?
Well, interestingly enough, our reliability numbers have been pretty good this summer. We've done a lot in terms of vegetation management, and by that I mean tree trimming on a regular basis. We anticipate spending about $12 million this year just on tree trimming alone, which is critical, obviously, to trim the trees or the vegetation away from the power lines to make sure that if there is a storm with high winds and lightning that you don't have the trees toppling on the lines. Now, you mentioned the derecho, which I had never heard of that term.
Neither had I until recently.
The end of June, early July, it caused significant damage. I think we had 54,000, 60,000 customers without power in the Delmarva Power Service territory. We were able to get – that storm came through on a Friday night into a Saturday morning. We had about 95% of the customers back on by Sunday night. The remaining 5% were back on by that following Tuesday afternoon. So we were in pretty good shape. What we do anytime there's a storm on the horizon, several days in advance, we're always monitoring the weather system. We're also making arrangements if need be, if we need what we call mutual assistance to get help from other utilities. The interesting challenge we had during that derecho was the fact that that was an unexpected occurrence. That came from out of nowhere. It was one of those freak weather occurrences. And once it hit, it not only hit our service territory, hit a lot of other surrounding utilities in the Mid-Atlantic region, which meant that when we reached out for mutual assistance, it was difficult to get help from the nearby utilities because they were impacted as we were. And so any utilities that would be coming from long distances would take several days to get here. Now, we were able to use local contractors to help us, but I do know some of our sister companies, Atlantic City Electric in southern New Jersey and Pepco out of Washington, they had to get contract crews from as far away as Canada and Oklahoma to come in and help with the restoration of power. Because in Washington, close to 500,000 people lost service in southern New Jersey, 225,000 people lost power. In fact, in New Jersey, some people lost power for about a week. So, but all in all, you do try to prepare in terms of looking what the forecast entails. What do we have available in terms of resources? And you make sure basically it's an all-hands-on-deck situation when we see significant storms on the horizon, because we want to make sure if the power goes out, we get it back on as quickly and as safely as possible.
Any lessons, by the way, learned from the derecho, the fact that it just sort of seemed to come out of nowhere?
I guess the key lesson is you just never know what's going to happen, so always be prepared. So, and we've done – well, what we do about three or four times a year, we have internal storm drills within the company, which here in this region, in our part of our service territory, entails about 350 employees that participate in these drills. We come up with hypothetical scenarios of various things and storms, what would happen, and you're issued a set of challenges. And how would you handle those challenges? What would your methods be? What would you tackle? What do you do to handle the situation? You know, interestingly enough, a lot of people don't realize, they think, well, all you have to do is dispatch the line crews and away you go. A lot of the behind-the-scenes logistical challenges are quite interesting. I can tell you that our sister company, Atlantic City Electric, since the power situation was such, all the available motel space had been taken up in southern New Jersey. And these extra line crews they had coming in from elsewhere, from New York, northern New Jersey, Canada, places like that, they had to make arrangements with two local colleges in southern New Jersey to use their dormitory space to give lodging to these linemen coming in. And in so doing, since they weren't in a normal motel where you already have your toiletry items given to you with bedding and things of this nature, they had to go to a local Kmart and just buy hundreds of dollars worth of linens, towels, and things of that nature. So there are a lot of elements to go into to handling the storm, not just putting the lights back on with reattaching the poles and the wires, but some behind-the-scenes stuff that pose a lot of challenges. So that was interesting. We had never had to do that before, at least our sister company, with housing linemen in college dormitories. So you just never know what's going to happen.
By the way, before we let you go, I have to turn to the Mid-Atlantic Power Pathway.
Okay.
Apparently, there's a recommendation to go ahead and scrap plans. First of all, what do you know about it? What was the rationale behind the decision? Because it certainly caused a lot of discussion here. Matter of fact, I think one of the first times we met was a discussion about that. What's the situation there?
Well, for your listeners who don't know, the Mid-Atlantic Power Pathway was as a planned 152-mile high-voltage transmission line that would start in northern Virginia, cross through southern Maryland under the Chesapeake Bay and through the Delmarva Peninsula to Millsboro, Delaware. The purpose was to enhance reliability in the Mid-Atlantic region. It was a billion-dollar project, and PJM, which is the organization that controls the electric grid in this region, their Transportation Expansion Advisory Committee has recommended that the program be scrapped or the project be scrapped at this time. Their board of managers will consider that recommendation later this month. We will live by that recommendation or what the final determination is. They have made the decision that the need for the project at this time has changed due to the economy, the downturn in the economy, a little bit more conservation on the part of people when it comes to energy usage. So the program, which had kind of been in limbo for the last 9 to 12 months, looks like now will probably will go by the boards, at least for the time being. So as I said, we're reviewing the recommendation of their advisory committee. We'll await the Board of Managers' decision later this month and live by that decision. But that was the intent of the project. It wasn't something that we instigated. It was we were doing it under the mandate of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as well as PJM. But their projections for the need for the project apparently have changed.
One of the things, by the way, I received, I think, was an email from, I guess, it was a citizens group, which obviously was pleased with the fact that the project did not go forward because they had serious questions about it. But one of the issues they raised, they said, it's a good thing that we delayed the project because if we hadn't, we would be in the midst of building this project when we'd actually didn't wind up needing it in the first place. What about that delay that the citizens created that you and I actually talked about back then?
Well, we spent over 2 years, Don, yeah, with public meetings, community meetings, trying to educate people on what we were intending to do. There were a lot of permitting processes that we had to go through from an environmental perspective, in both in Maryland and Delaware. And the reason we were doing a lot of the extensive planning, because to give you an example, the underground or the underwater cable that
right.
would go into the Chesapeake Bay, that had to be ordered 2 years in advance from an overseas company in the Netherlands, and so things like that. That's why it was such a long range project. It wasn't one of these things where. Let's build a line. Let's do it tomorrow. And that's why there was an extensive amount of lead time in trying to get this project off the ground. Plus, there were certain tracts of land we had to purchase. Dorchester County in particular, we didn't have any right-of-way that we own, so we had to go out and make a lot of arrangements in terms of land purchases so we could build the line.
Just briefly, about 30 seconds, do you think, were you surprised at the kind of strong outcry that certainly I saw in Dorchester County?
Well, initially, you know, it's interesting. Initially, there was a lot of opposition to the project, but I think, in all honesty, over the two plus years we did with community outreach, we brought a lot of the naysayers over to our side to explain to them the need for the project from a reliability standpoint and also how it would help economically in terms of improving the job situation in that county.
We've been speaking with Matt Lukovich. He's with Delmarva Power. Also, Jennifer Johnson. She's with the Wicomico County Health Department. And Jay Apperson. He's with the Maryland Department of the Environment. We've been talking about, of course, the drought, its impact, both in terms of water and in terms of power, as well as one's health. And, of course, we just touched on the end, what appears to be anyway, the end of the Mid-Atlantic Power Pathway. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.